reminders that there will be a future. Winning a foothold on other worlds whispers in our ears that we're more than Picts or Serbs or Tongans. We're humans. Exploratory spaceflight puts scientific ideas, scientific thinking, and scientific vocabulary in the public eye. It elevates the general level of intellectual inquiry, the idea that we've now understood something never grasped by anyone who ever lived before. That exhilaration, especially intense for the scientists involved, but perceptible to nearly everyone, propagates through the society, bounces off the walls, and comes back at us. It encourages us to address problems in other fields that have also never before been solved. It increases the general sense of optimism in the society. It gives currency to critical thinking of the sort urgently needed if we are to solve hitherto intractable social issues. It helps stimulate a new generation of scientists. The more science in the media, especially if methods are described, as well as conclusions and implications, the healthier I believe the society is. People everywhere hunger to understand. When I was a child, my most exultant dreams were about flying, not in some machine, but all by myself. I would be skipping or hopping, and slowly I could pull my trajectory higher. It would take longer to fall back to the ground. Soon, I would be on such a high arc that I wouldn't come down at all. I would alight like a gargoyle in a niche near the pinnacle of a skyscraper, or gently settle down on a cloud. In the dream, which I must have had in its many variations at least 100 times, achieving flight required a certain cast of mind. It's impossible to describe it in words, but I can remember what it was like to this day. You did something inside your head and at the pit of your stomach, and then you could lift yourself up by an effort of will alone, your limbs hanging limply. Off you'd soar. I know many people have had similar dreams. Maybe most people. Maybe everyone. Perhaps it goes back 10 million years or more, when our ancestors were gracefully flinging themselves from branch to branch in the primeval forest. A wish to soar like the birds motivated many of the pioneers of flight, including Leonardo da Vinci and the Wright brothers. Maybe that's part of the appeal of spaceflight, too. In orbit about any world, or in interplanetary flight, you are literally weightless. You can propel yourself to the spacecraft's ceiling with a slight push off the floor. You can go tumbling through the air down the long axis of the spacecraft. Humans experience weightlessness as joy. This has been reported by almost every astronaut and cosmonaut. But because spacecraft are still so small, and because spacewalks have been done with extreme caution, no human has yet enjoyed this wonder and glory. Propelling yourself by an almost imperceptible push, with no machinery driving you, untethered, high up into the sky, into the blackness of interplanetary space. You become a living satellite of the Earth, or a human planet of the Sun. Planetary exploration satisfies our inclination for great enterprises and wanderings and quests that has been with us since our days as hunters and gatherers on the East African savannas 1 million years ago. By chance, it is possible, I say, to imagine many skeins of historical causality in which this would not have transpired. In our age, we are able to begin again. Exploring other worlds employs precisely the same qualities of daring, planning, cooperative enterprise, and valor that mark the finest in the military tradition. Never mind the night launch of an Apollo spacecraft bound for another world. That makes the conclusion foregone. Witness Mir F-14s taking off from adjacent flight decks, gracefully canting left and right, afterburners flaming. And there's something that sweeps you away, or at least it does me. And no amount of knowledge of the potential abuses of carrier task forces can affect the depth of that feeling. It simply speaks to another part of me. It doesn't want recriminations or politics. It just wants to fly. I had ambition not only to go farther than anyone had done before, wrote Captain James Cook, the 18th century explorer of the Pacific, but as far as it was possible for man to go. 2 centuries later, Yuri Romanenko, on returning to Earth after what was then the longest spaceflight in history, said, "The cosmos is a magnet. Once you've been there, all you can think of is how to get back." Even Jean-Jacques Rousseau, no enthusiast of technology, felt it. The stars are far above us. We need preliminary instruction, instruments, and machines, which are like so many immense ladders, enabling us to approach them and bring them within our grasp. The future possibilities of space travel, wrote the philosopher Bertrand Russell in 1959, which are now left mainly to unfounded fantasy, could be more soberly treated without ceasing to be interesting, and could show to even the most adventurous of the young that a world without war need not be a world without adventurous and hazardous glory. To this kind of contest, there is no limit. Each victory is only a prelude to another, and no boundaries can be set to rational hope. In the long run, these, more than any of the practical justifications considered earlier, may be the reasons we will go to Mars and other worlds. In the meantime, the most important step we can take toward Mars is to make a significant progress on Earth. Even modest improvements in the social, economic, and political problems that our global civilization now faces could release enormous resources, both material and human, for other goals. There's plenty of housework to be done here on Earth, and our commitment to it must be steadfast. But we're the kind of species that needs a frontier for fundamental biological reasons. Every time humanity stretches itself and turns a new corner, it receives a jolt of productive vitality that can carry it for centuries. There's a new world next door, and we know how to get there. Chapter 17. Routine Interplanetary Violence. It is a law of nature that Earth and all other bodies should remain in their proper places and be moved from them only by violence. Aristotle, 384 to 322 BC. Physics. There was something funny about Saturn. When in 1610 Galileo used the world's first astronomical telescope to view the planet, then the most distant world known, he found 2 appendages, one on either side. He likened them to handles. Other astronomers call them ears. The cosmos holds many wonders, but a planet with jug ears is dismaying. Galileo went to his grave with this bizarre matter unresolved. As the years passed, observers found the ears, well, waxing and waning. Eventually, it became clear that what Galileo had discovered was an extremely thin ring that surrounds Saturn at its equator, but touches it nowhere. In some years, because of the changing orbital positions of Earth and Saturn, the ring had been seen edge-on, and, because of its thinness, it seemed to disappear. In other years, it had been viewed more face-on, and the ears grew bigger. But what does it mean that there's a ring around Saturn? A thin, flat, solid plate with a hole cut out for the planet to fit into. Where does that come from? This line of inquiry will shortly take us to world-shattering collisions, to two quite different perils for our species, and to a reason, beyond those already described, that we must, for our very survival, be out there among the planets. We now know that the rings, emphatically plural, of Saturn are a vast hoard of tiny ice worlds, each on a separate orbit, each bound to Saturn by the giant planet's gravity. In size, these worldlets range from particles of fine dust to houses. None is big enough to photograph even from close flybys. Spaced out in an exquisite set of fine concentric circles, something like the grooves on a phonograph record, which in reality make, of course, a spiral. The rings were first revealed in their true majesty by the two Voyager spacecraft in their 1980-81 flybys. In our century, the Art Deco rings of Saturn have become an icon of the future. At a scientific meeting in the late 1960s, I was asked to summarize the outstanding problems in planetary science. One, I suggested, was the question of why, of all the planets, only Saturn had rings. This, Voyager discovered, is a non-question. All four giant planets in our solar system, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, in fact, have rings. But no one knew it then. Each ring system has distinctive features. Jupiter's is tenuous and made mainly of dark, very small particles. The bright rings of Saturn are composed mainly of frozen water. There are thousands of separate rings here, some twisted with strange, dusky, spoke-like markings forming and dissipating. The dark rings of Uranus seem to be composed of elemental carbon and organic molecules, something like charcoal or chimney soot. Uranus has 9 main rings, a few of which seem to breathe, expanding and contracting. Neptune's rings are the most tenuous of all, varying so much in thickness that when detected from Earth, they appear only as arcs and incomplete circles. A number of rings seem to be maintained by the gravitational tugs of 2 shepherd moons, one a little nearer and the other a little farther from the planet than the ring. Each ring system displays its own appropriately unearthly beauty. How do rings form? One possibility is tides. If an errant world passes close to a planet, the interloper's near side is gravitationally pulled toward the planet more than its far side. If it comes close enough, if its internal cohesion is low enough, it can be literally torn to pieces. Occasionally, we see this happening to comets as they pass too close to Jupiter or the Sun. Another possibility, emerging from the Voyager reconnaissance of the outer solar system, is this. Rings are made when worlds collide, and moons are smashed to smithereens. Both mechanisms may have played a role. The space between the planets is traversed by an odd collection of rogue worldlets, each in orbit about the Sun. A few are as big as a county or even a state. Many more have surface areas like those of a village or a town. More little ones are found then big ones, and they range in size down to particles of dust. Some of them travel on long, stretched-out elliptical paths, which make them periodically cross the orbit of one or more planets. Occasionally, unluckily, there's a world in the way. The collision can shatter and pulverize both the interloper and the moon that's hit, or at least the region around ground zero. The resulting debris ejected from the moon, but not so fast moving as to escape from the planet's gravity, may form, for a time, a new ring. It's made of whatever the colliding bodies were made of, but usually more of the target moon than the rogue impactor. If the colliding worlds are icy, the net result will be rings of ice particles. If they're made of organic molecules, the result will be rings of organic particles, which will slowly be processed by radiation into carbon. All the mass in the rings of Saturn is no more than will result from the complete impact pulverization of a single icy moon. The disintegration of small moons can likewise account for the ring systems of the three other giant planets. Unless it's very close to its planet, a shattered moon gradually reaccumulates, or at least a fair fraction of it does. The pieces, big and small, still in approximately the same orbit as the moon was before the impact, fall together helter-skelter. What used to be a piece of the core is now at the surface, and vice versa. The resulting hodgepodge surfaces might seem very odd. Miranda, one of the moons of Uranus, looks disconcertingly jumbled and may have had such an origin. The American planetary geologist Eugene Shoemaker proposes that many moons in the outer solar system have been annihilated and reformed, not just once, but several times each over the 4.5 billion years since the sun and the planets condensed out of interstellar gas and dust. The picture emerging from the Voyager reconnaissance of the outer solar system is of worlds whose placid and lonely vigils are spasmodically troubled by interlopers from space, of world-shattering collisions, and of moons reforming from debris, reconstituting themselves like phoenixes from their own ashes. But a moon that lives very close to a planet cannot reform if it is pulverized. The gravitational tides of the nearby planet prevent it. The resulting debris, once spread out into a ring system, might be very long-lived, at least by the standard of a human lifetime. Perhaps many of the small, inconspicuous moons now orbiting the giant planets will one day blossom forth into vast and lovely rings. These ideas are supported by the appearance of a number of satellites in the solar system. Phobos, the inner moon of Mars, has a large crater named Stickney. Mimas, an inner moon of Saturn, has a big one named Herschel. These craters, like those on our own moon, and indeed throughout the solar system, are produced by collisions. An interloper smashes into a bigger world and makes an immense explosion at the point of impact. A bowl-shaped crater is excavated, and a smaller impacting object is destroyed. If the interlopers that dug out the Stickney and Herschel craters had been only a little larger, they would have had enough energy to blow Phobos and Mimas to bits. These moons barely escaped the cosmic wrecking ball. Many others did not. Every time a world is smashed into, there's one less interloper, something like a demolition derby on the scale of the solar system, a war of attrition. The very fact that many such collisions have occurred means that the rogue worldlets have been largely used up. Those on circular trajectories around the sun, those that don't intersect the orbits of other worlds, will be unlikely to smash into a planet. Those on highly elliptical trajectories, those that cross the orbits of other planets will sooner or later collide or, by a near miss, be gravitationally ejected from the solar system. The planets almost certainly accumulated from worldlets which in turn had condensed out of a great flat cloud of gas and dust surrounding the sun, a sort of cloud that can now be seen around young nearby stars. So in the early history of the solar system, before collisions cleaned things up, there should have been many more worldlets than we see today. Indeed, there is clear evidence for this in our own backyard. If we count up the interloper worldlets in our neighborhood in space, we can estimate how often they'll hit the moon. Let us make the very modest assumption that the population of interlopers has never been smaller than it is today. We can then calculate how many craters there should be on the moon. The number we figure turns out to be much less than the number we see on the moon's ravaged highlands. The unexpected profusion of craters on the moon speaks to us of an earlier epoch when the solar system was in wild turmoil, churning with worlds on collision trajectories. This makes good sense, because they formed from the aggregation of much smaller worldlets, which themselves had grown out of interstellar dust. 4 billion years ago, the lunar impacts were hundreds of times more frequent than they are today. And 4.5 billion years ago, when the planets were still incomplete, collisions happened perhaps a billion times more often than in our becalmed epoch. The chaos may have been relieved by much more flamboyant ring systems than grace the planets today. If they had small moons in that time, the Earth, Mars, and the other small planets may also have been adorned with rings. The most satisfactory explanation of the origin of our own moon, based on its chemistry as revealed by samples returned from the Apollo missions, is that it was formed almost 4.5 billion years ago, when a world the size of Mars struck the Earth. Much of our planet's rocky mantle was reduced to dust and hot gas and blasted into space. Some of the debris in orbit around the Earth then gradually reaccumulated, atom by atom, boulder by boulder. If that unknown impacting world had been only a little larger, the result would have been the obliteration of the Earth. Perhaps there once were other worlds in our solar system, perhaps even worlds on which life was stirring, hit by some demon worldlet, utterly demolished, and of which today we have not even an intimation. The emerging picture of the early solar system does not resemble a stately progression of events designed to form the Earth. Instead, it looks as if our planet was made and survived by mere lucky chance amid unbelievable violence. Our world does not seem to have been sculpted by a master craftsman. Here, too, there is no hint of a universe made for us. The dwindling supply of worldlets is today variously labeled asteroids, comets, small moons. But these are arbitrary categories. Real worldlets are able to breach these human-made partitions. Some asteroids, the word means star-like, which they certainly are not, are rocky, others metallic, still others rich in organic matter. None is bigger than 1,000 kilometers across. They are found mainly in a belt between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. Astronomers once thought the main belt asteroids were the remains of a demolished world, but as I've been describing, another idea is now more fashionable. The solar system was once filled with asteroid-like worlds, some of which went into building the planets. Only in the asteroid belt, near Jupiter, did the gravitational tides of this most massive planet prevent the nearby debris from coalescing into a new world. The asteroids, instead of representing a world that once was, seem to be the building blocks of a world destined never to be. Down to kilometer size, there may be several million asteroids, but in the enormous volume of interplanetary space, even that's still far too few to cause any serious hazard to spacecraft on their way to the outer solar system. The first main belt asteroids, Gaspra and Ida, were photographed in 1991 and 1993 respectively by the Galileo spacecraft on its tortuous journey to Jupiter. Main belt asteroids mostly stay at home. To investigate them, we must go and visit them, as Galileo did. Comets, on the other hand, sometimes come and visit us, as Halley's Comet did most recently in 1910 and 1986. Comets are made mainly of ice, plus smaller amounts of rocky and organic material. When heated, the ice vaporizes, forming the long and lovely tails blown outward by the solar wind and the pressure of sunlight. After many passages by the sun, the ice is all evaporated, sometimes leaving a dead, rocky, and organic world. Sometimes the remaining particles, the ice that held them together now gone, spread out in the comet's orbit, generating a debris trail around the sun. Every time a bit of cometary fluff the size of a grain of sand enters the Earth's atmosphere at high speed, it burns up, producing a momentary trail of light that Earthbound observers call a sporadic meteor or shooting star. Some disintegrating comets have orbits that cross the Earth's. So every year, the Earth, on its steady circumnavigation of the sun, also plunges through belts of orbiting cometary debris. We may then witness a meteor shower or even a meteor storm, the skies ablaze with the body parts of a comet. For example, the Perseid meteors, seen on or about August 12th of each year, originate in a dying comet called Swift-Tuttle. But the beauty of a meteor shower should not deceive us. There is a continuum that connects these shimmering visitors to our night skies with the destruction of worlds. A few asteroids, now and then, give off little puffs of gas, or even form a temporary tail, suggesting that they are in transition between cometdom and asteroidhood. Some small moons going around the planets are probably captured asteroids or comets. The moons of Mars and the outer satellites of Jupiter may be in this category. Gravity smooths down everything that sticks out too far. But only in large bodies is the gravity enough to make mountains and other projections collapse of their own weight, rounding the world. And indeed, when we observe their shapes, almost always we find that small worldlets are lumpy, irregular, potato-shaped. There are astronomers whose idea of a good time is to stay up till dawn on a cold, moonless night, taking pictures of the sky, the same sky they photographed the year before, and the year before that. If they got it right last time, you might well ask, why are they doing it again? The answer is, the sky changes. In any given year, there might be worldlets wholly unknown, never seen before, that approach the Earth and are spied by these dedicated observers. On March 25, 1993, a group of asteroid and comet hunters, looking at the photographic harvest from an intermittently cloudy night at Mount Palomar in California, discovered a faint, elongated smudge on their films. It was near a very bright object in the sky, the planet Jupiter. Carolyn and Eugene Shoemaker and David Levy then asked other observers to take a look. The smudge turned out to be something astonishing. Some 20 small, bright objects orbiting Jupiter, one behind the other, like pearls on a string. Collectively, they are called Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9. This is the 9th time that these collaborators have together discovered a periodic comet. But calling these objects a comet is confusing. There was a hoard of them, probably the fragmented remains of a single, hitherto undiscovered comet. It silently orbited the Sun for 4 billion years before passing too close to Jupiter and being captured a few decades ago by the gravity of the solar system's largest planet. On July 7, 1992, it was torn apart by Jupiter's gravitational tides. You can recognize that the inner part of such a comet would be pulled toward Jupiter a little more strongly than the outer part, because the inner part is closer to Jupiter than the outer part. The difference in pull is certainly small. Our feet are a little closer to the center of the Earth than our heads. But we are not in consequence torn to pieces by the Earth's gravity. For such tidal disruption to have occurred, the original comet must have been held together very weakly. Before fragmentation, it was, we think, a loosely consolidated mass of ice, rock, and organic matter, maybe 10 kilometers, about 6 miles across. The orbit of this disrupted comet was then determined to high precision. Between July 16 and 22, 1994, all the cometary fragments, one after another, collided with Jupiter. The biggest pieces seem to have been a few kilometers across. Their impacts with Jupiter were spectacular. No one knew beforehand what these multiple impacts into the atmosphere and clouds of Jupiter would do. Perhaps the cometary fragments, surrounded by halos of dust, were much smaller than they seemed. Or perhaps they were not coherent bodies at all, but loosely consolidated, something like a heap of gravel with all the particles traveling through space together in nearly identical orbits. If either of these possibilities were true, Jupiter might swallow the comets without a trace. Other astronomers thought there would at least be bright fireballs and giant plumes as the cometary fragments plunged into the atmosphere. Still others suggested that the dense cloud of fine particles accompanying the fragments of Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 into Jupiter would disrupt the magnetosphere of Jupiter or form a new ring. A comet this size should impact Jupiter, it is calculated, only once every 1,000 years. It's the astronomical event not of one lifetime, but of a dozen. Nothing on this scale has occurred since the invention of the telescope. So in mid-July 1994, in a beautifully coordinated international scientific effort, telescopes all over the Earth and in space turned towards Jupiter. Astronomers have had over a year to prepare. The trajectories of the fragments and their orbits around Jupiter were estimated. It was discovered that they would all hit Jupiter. Predictions of the timing were refined. Disappointingly, the calculations revealed that all impacts would occur on the night side of Jupiter, the side invisible from the Earth, although accessible to the Galileo and Voyager spacecraft in the outer solar system. But happily, all impacts would occur only a few minutes before the Jovian dawn, before the impact site would be carried by Jupiter's rotation into the line of sight from Earth. The appointed moment for the impact of the first piece, Fragment A, came and went. There were no reports from ground-based telescopes. Planetary scientists stared with increasing gloom at a television monitor displaying the data transmitted to the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore from the Hubble Space Telescope. There was nothing anomalous. Shuttle astronauts took time off from the reproduction of fruit flies, fish, and newts, to look at Jupiter through binoculars. They reported seeing nothing. The impact of the millennium was beginning to look very much like a fizzle. Then, there was a report from the ground-based optical telescope in La Palma, in the Canary Islands, followed by announcements from a radio telescope in Japan, from the European Southern Observatory in Chile, and from a University of Chicago instrument in the frigid wastelands of the South Pole. In Baltimore, the young scientists crowded around the TV monitor, themselves monitored by the cameras of CNN, began to see something, and in exactly the right place on Jupiter. You could witness consternation turn into puzzlement, and then exultation. They cheered. They screamed. They jumped up and down. Smiles filled the room. They broke out the champagne. Here was a group of young American scientists, about a third of them, including the team leader, Heidi Hamel, women. And you could imagine youngsters all over the world thinking that it might be fun to be a scientist, that this might be a good daytime job, or even a means to spiritual fulfillment. For many of the fragments, observers somewhere on Earth noticed the fireball rise so quickly and so high that it could be seen even though the impact site below it was still in Jovian darkness. Plumes ascended and then flattened into pancake-like forms. Spreading out from the point of impact, we could see sound and gravity waves, and a patch of discoloration that for the largest fragments became as big as the Earth. Slamming into Jupiter at 60 kilometers a second, 130,000 miles an hour, the large fragments converted their kinetic energy partly into shock waves, partly into heat. The temperature in the fireball was estimated at thousands of degrees. Some of the fireballs and plumes were far brighter than all the rest of Jupiter put together. What is the cause of the dark stains left after the impact? It might be stuff from the deep clouds of Jupiter, from the region to which ground-based observers cannot ordinarily see, that welled up and spread out. However, the fragments do not seem to have penetrated to such depths. Or the molecules responsible for the stains might have been in the cometary fragments in the first place. We know from the Vega 1 and 2 Soviet missions and the Giotto mission of the European Space Agency, both to Halley's Comet, that comets may be as much as a quarter composed of complex organic molecules. They are the reason that the nucleus of Halley's Comet is pitch black. If some of the cometary organics survived the impact events, they may have been responsible for the stain. Or finally, the stain may be due to organic matter not delivered by the impacting cometary fragments, but synthesized by their shock waves from the atmosphere of Jupiter. Impact of the fragments of comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 with Jupiter was witnessed on 7 continents. Even amateur astronomers with small telescopes could see the plumes and the subsequent discoloration of the Jovian clouds. Just as sporting events are covered at all angles by television cameras on the field and from a dirigible high overhead, 6 NASA spacecraft deployed throughout the solar system with different observational specialties recorded this new wonder. The Hubble Space Telescope, the International Ultraviolet Explorer, and the Extreme Ultraviolet Explorer, all in Earth orbit. Ulysses taking time out from its investigation of the South Pole of the Sun. Galileo on the way to its own rendezvous with Jupiter. And Voyager 2, far beyond Neptune, on its way to the stars. As the data are accumulated and analyzed, our knowledge of comets, of Jupiter, and of the violent collisions of worlds should all be substantially improved. For many scientists, but especially for Carolyn and Eugene Shoemaker and David Levy. There was something poignant about the commentary fragments, one after the other, making their death plunges into Jupiter. They had lived with this comet, in a matter of speaking, for 16 months, watched it split, the pieces enshrouded by clouds of dust, playing hide-and-seek and spreading out in their orbits. In a limited way, each fragment had its own personality. Now they're all gone, ablated into molecules and atoms in the upper atmosphere of the solar system's largest planet. In a way, we almost mourn them. But we're learning from their fiery deaths. It is perhaps some reassurance to know that there are 100 trillion more of them in the sun's vast treasure house of worlds. There are about 200 known asteroids whose paths take them near the Earth. They are called, appropriately enough, near-Earth asteroids. Their detailed appearance, like that of their main belt cousins, immediately implies that they are the products of a violent collisional history. Many of them may be the shards and remnants of once larger worldlets. With a few exceptions, the near-Earth asteroids are only a few kilometers across or smaller, and take one to a few years to make a circuit around the sun. About 20% of them, sooner or later, are bound to hit the Earth, with devastating consequences. But in astronomy, sooner or later can encompass billions of years. Cicero's assurance that nothing of chance or hazard is to be found in an absolutely ordered and regular heaven is a profound misperception. Even today, as comet Shoemaker-Levy 9's encounter with Jupiter reminds us, there is routine interplanetary violence, although not on the scale that marked the early history of the solar system. Like main belt asteroids, many near-Earth asteroids are rocky. A few are mainly metal, and it has been suggested that enormous rewards might attend moving such an asteroid into orbit around the Earth and then systematically mining it, a mountain of high-grade ore a few hundred miles overhead. The value of platinum group metals alone in a single such world has been estimated as many trillions of dollars, although the unit price would plummet spectacularly if such materials became widely available. Methods of extracting metals and minerals from appropriate asteroids are being studied, for example, by John Lewis, a planetary scientist at the University of Arizona. Some near-Earth asteroids are rich in organic matter, apparently preserved from the very earliest solar system. Some have been found by Stephen Ostro of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory to be double, two bodies in contact. Perhaps a larger world has broken in two as it passed through the strong gravitational tides of a planet like Jupiter. More interesting is the possibility that two worlds on similar orbits made a gentle, overtaking collision and stuck. This process may have been key to the building of planets and the Earth. At least one asteroid, Ida, as viewed by Galileo, has its own small moon. We might guess that two asteroids in contact and two asteroids orbiting one another have related origins. Sometimes we hear about an asteroid making a near miss. Why do we call it a near miss? A near hit is what we really mean. But then we read a little more carefully, and it turns out that its closest approach to the Earth was several hundreds of thousands or millions of kilometers. That doesn't count. That's too far away, farther even than the moon. If we had an inventory of all the near-Earth asteroids, including those considerably smaller than a kilometer across, we could project their orbits into the future and predict which ones are potentially dangerous. There are an estimated 2,000 of them, bigger than a kilometer across, of which we have actually observed only a few percent. There are maybe 200,000 bigger than 100 meters in diameter. The near-Earth asteroids have evocative mythological names. Orpheus, Hathor, Icarus, Adonis, Apollo, Cerberus, Khufu, Amor, Tantalus, Aten, Midas, Ra Shalom, Phaethon, Tutatis, Quetzalcoatl. There are a few of special exploratory potential. For example, Nereus. In general, it's much easier to get onto and off of near-Earth asteroids than the Moon. Nereus, a tiny world about a kilometer across, is one of the easiest. It would be real exploration of a truly new world. Some humans, all from the former Soviet Union, have already been in space for periods longer than the entire round-trip time to Nereus. The rocket technology to get there already exists. It's a much smaller step than going to Mars, or even, in several respects, than returning to the Moon. If something went wrong, though, we would be unable to run home to safety in only a few days. In this respect, its level of difficulty lies somewhere between a voyage to Mars and one to the Moon. Of many possible future missions to Nereus, there's one that takes 10 months to get there from Earth, spends 30 days there, and then requires only 3 weeks to return to home. We could visit Nereus with robots, or, if we're up to it, with humans. We could examine this little world's shape, constitution, interior, past history, organic chemistry, cosmic evolution, and possible tie to comets. We could bring samples back for examination at leisure in Earth-bound laboratories. We could investigate whether there really are commercially valuable resources, metals, or minerals there. If we are ever going to send humans to Mars, near-Earth asteroids provide a convenient and appropriate intermediate goal to test out the equipment and exploratory protocols while studying an almost wholly unknown little world. Here's a way to get our feet wet again when we're ready to re-enter the cosmic ocean. Chapter 18, The Marsh of Camerina. It's too late to make any improvements now. The universe is finished. The copestone is on. And the chips were carted off a million years ago. Herman Melville, Moby Dick, Chapter 2, 1851. Camerina was a city in southern Sicily, founded by colonists from Syracuse in 598 BC. A generation or two later, it was threatened by a pestilence, festering, some said, in the adjacent marsh. While the germ theory of disease was certainly not widely accepted in the ancient world, there were hints. For example, Marcus Varro in the first century BC advised explicitly against building cities near swamps. He wrote, "Because there are bred certain minute creatures which cannot be seen by the eyes, which float in the air and enter the body through the mouth and nose, and there cause serious disease." The danger to Camerina was great. Plans were drawn to drain the marsh. When the oracle was consulted, though, it forbade such a course of action, counseling patience instead. But lives were at stake. The oracle was ignored, and the marsh was drained. The pestilence was promptly halted. Too late, it was recognized that the marsh had protected the city from its enemies, among whom there had now to be counted their cousins, the the Syracusans. As in America, 2,300 years later, the colonists had quarreled with the mother country. In 552 BC, a Syracusan force crossed over the dry land where the marsh had been, slaughtered every man, woman, and child, and razed the city. The marsh of Camarina became proverbial for eliminating a danger in such a way as to usher in another, much worse. The Cretaceous-Tertiary collision, or collisions, there may have been more than one, illuminates the peril from asteroids and comets. In sequence, a world-immolating fire burned vegetation to a crisp all over the planet. A stratospheric dust cloud so darkened the sky that surviving plants had trouble making a living from photosynthesis. There were worldwide freezing temperatures, torrential rains of caustic acids, massive depletion of the ozone layer. And to top it off, after the Earth healed itself from these assaults, a prolonged greenhouse warming, because the main impact seems to have volatilized a deep layer of sedimentary carbonates, pouring huge amounts of carbon dioxide into the air. It was not a single catastrophe, but a parade of them, a concatenation of terrors. Organisms weakened by one disaster were finished off by the next. It is quite uncertain whether our civilization would survive even a considerably less energetic collision. Since there are many more small asteroids than large ones, run-of-the-mill collisions with the Earth will be made by the little guys. But the longer you're prepared to wait, the more devastating the impact you can expect. On average, once every few hundred years, the Earth is hit by an object about 70 meters in diameter. The resulting energy released is equivalent to the largest nuclear weapons explosion ever detonated. Every 10,000 years, we're hit by a 200-meter object that might induce serious regional climatic effects. Every million years, an impact by a body over 2 kilometers in diameter occurs, equivalent to nearly a million megatons of TNT, an explosion that would work a global catastrophe, killing, unless unprecedented precautions were taken, a significant fraction of the human species. A million megatons of TNT is 100 times the explosive yield of all the nuclear weapons on the planet if simultaneously blown up. Dwarfing even this, in 100 million years or so, you can bet on something like the Cretaceous-Tertiary event, the impact of a world 10 kilometers across or bigger. The destructive energy latent in a large near-Earth asteroid dwarfs anything else the human species can get its hands on. As first shown by the American planetary scientist Christopher Chiba and his colleagues, little asteroids or comets, a few tens of meters across, break and burn up on entering our atmosphere. They arrive comparatively often, but do no significant harm. Some idea of how frequently they enter the Earth's atmosphere has been revealed by declassified Department of Defense data obtained from special satellites monitoring the Earth for clandestine nuclear explosions. There seem to have been hundreds of small worldlets and at least one larger body impacting in the last 20 years. They did no harm. But we need to be very sure we can distinguish a small colliding comet or asteroid from an atmospheric nuclear explosion. Civilization-threatening impacts require bodies several hundred meters across or more. A meter is about a yard. 100 meters is roughly the length of a football field. They arrive something like once every 200,000 years. Our civilization is only about 10,000 years old, so we should have no institutional memory of the last such impact. Nor do we. Comet Shoemaker Levy 9, in its succession of fiery explosions on Jupiter in July 1994, reminds us that such impacts really do occur in our time, and that the impact of a body a few kilometers across can spread debris over an area as big as the Earth. It was a kind of portent. In the very week of the Shoemaker-Levy impact, the Science and Space Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives drafted legislation that requires NASA, in coordination with the Department of Defense and the space agencies of other countries, to identify and determine the orbital characteristics of all Earth-approaching comets and asteroids that are greater than 1 kilometer in diameter. The work is to be completed by the year 2005. Such a search program had been advocated by many planetary scientists, but it took the death throes of a comet to move it toward practical implementation. Spread out over the waiting time, the dangers of asteroid collision do not seem very worrisome. But if a big impact happens, it would be an unprecedented human catastrophe. There's something like 1 chance in 2,000 that such a collision will happen in the lifetime of a newborn baby. Most of us would not fly in an airplane if the chance of crashing were 1 in 2,000. In fact, for commercial flights, the chance is 1 in 2 million. Even so, many people consider this large enough to worry about, or even to take out insurance for. When our lives are at stake, we often change our behavior to arrange more favorable odds. Those who don't tend to be no longer with us. Perhaps we should practice getting to these worldlets and diverting their orbits should the hour of need ever arise. Melville, notwithstanding, some of the chips of creation are still left, and improvements evidently need to be made. Along parallel and only weakly interacting tracks, the planetary science community and the U.S. and Russian nuclear weapons laboratories, aware of the foregoing scenarios, have been pursuing these questions. How to monitor all sizable near-Earth interplanetary objects? How to characterize their physical and chemical nature? How to predict which ones may be on a future collision trajectory with Earth? And finally, how to prevent a collision from happening. The Russian spaceflight pioneer Konstantin Tsiolkovsky argued a century ago that there must be bodies intermediate in size between the observed large asteroids and those asteroidal fragments, the meteorites, that occasionally fall to Earth. He wrote about living on small asteroids in interplanetary space. He did not have military applications in mind. In the early 1980s, though, some in the U.S. weapons establishment argued that the Soviets might use near-Earth asteroids as first-strike weapons. The alleged plan was called Ivan's Hammer. Countermeasures were needed. But at the same time, it was suggested maybe it wasn't a bad idea for the United States to learn how to use small worlds as weapons of its own. The Defense Department's Ballistic Missile Defense Organization, the successor to the Star Wars office of the 1980s, launched an innovative spacecraft called Clementine to orbit the moon and fly by the near-Earth asteroid, Geographos. After completing a remarkable reconnaissance of the moon in May 1994, the spacecraft failed before it could reach Geographos. In principle, you could use big rocket engines or projectile impact, or equip the asteroid with giant reflective panels and shove it with sunlight or powerful Earth-based lasers. But with technology that exists right now, there are only two ways. First, one or more high-yield nuclear weapons might blast the asteroid or comet into fragments that would disintegrate and atomize on entering the Earth's atmosphere, If the offending worldlet is only weakly held together, perhaps only hundreds of megatons would suffice. Since there is no theoretical upper limit to the explosive yield of a thermo